ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Beef producers across regional Australia respond to Trump's tariffs.
Well, it's going to make the product 10% dearer for someone. And from our point of view, it'll be the importer and the American consumer. There's a lot of demand for Aussie beef around the world. So I think they're playing with a little bit of fire.
And even apex predators can face threats to their survival.
And then one of those species that not a lot of people know about, so they're one of those species that could sort of fade into extinction without too much fanfare or fuss. So we're here to make sure that doesn't happen.
Saving the spotted quoll. I'm Alex Barwick and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Alice Springs and Bantwa, bringing you stories from across regional and remote Australia. Trump has announced his latest round of tariffs and, as expected, Australian beef is in the firing line. But there are lots of questions. What does this mean for producers across regional and remote Australia? How will it affect livelihoods? And are there flow-on effects for Australians purchasing mince, round steak or roast at the supermarket for dinner next week? Let's unpack what we know so far. Donald Trump called it Liberation Day as he imposed a raft of sweeping tariffs as part of his trade policy. This means virtually all imports to the United States, including from Australia, will be hit with an import tax of at least 10%, while dozens of other countries received much higher reciprocal tariffs.
For decades, our country has been looted, pillaged, raped, and plundered by nations near and far, both friend and foe alike. Our country and its taxpayers have been ripped off for more than 50 years, but it is not going to happen anymore.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said the tariff measures were not the actions of a friend.
For Australia, these tariffs are not unexpected, but let me be clear, they are totally unwarranted. The administration's tariffs have no basis in logic, and they go against the basis of our two nations' partnership. This is not the act of a friend. It is the American people who will pay the biggest price for these unjustified tariffs. This is why our government will not be seeking to impose reciprocal tariffs. We will not join a race to the bottom that leads to higher prices and slower growth.
That's the PM speaking earlier today. Well, what does it all mean? Michael Condon is the presenter of the New South Wales Country Hour and he's with me this afternoon. Michael, can you explain in practical terms what these tariffs mean and how they will take effect?
Well, they'll take effect from midnight tonight, I understand it, and 10% on top of the price that they pay for beef, which will then, I understand it, in America, it will be paid when we send it over, the shipment goes over, it will be immediately subject to a 10% tariff, which will be paid in America. And as the point is made, ultimately that will then be immediately passed on to the US consumer. But the question is then whether that will drop the demand for Australian beef as a result of that. So, you know, and that is a concern because last year we sent 400,000 tons of beef to the US. That was up 60% on 2023 with $4 billion worth of Australian exports. We are now the biggest exporter of beef into the US because they've reduced the amount of beef they get from Mexico and Canada.
Well, let's hear what Donald Trump had to say about why he is targeting Australian beef.
Australia bans, and they're wonderful people and wonderful everything, but they ban American beef, yet we imported $3 billion of Australian beef from them just last year alone. They won't take any of our beef. They don't want it because they don't want it to affect their farmers. And you know what? I don't blame them, but we're doing the same thing right now, starting about midnight tonight, I would say.
Michael, is that true? Trump claims we've banned U.S. beef. Is that the case? What is our position on U.S. beef imports?
We don't import a US beef. It's not technically called a ban. It's actually because of a biosecurity issue with mad cow disease, BSE, which is still in the US herd. There's no way of testing it in live animals. The only way you can test it is in dead animals. You see it in the brain. Although you know, other pundits say the number of cattle in the US that have BSE is extremely small now, so it's really shouldn't be an issue anymore. But Anthony Albanese, the Prime Minister, was saying he's not going to negotiate on that issue. The beef industry in Australia is saying they don't want to negotiate on that issue. That's a no-go area for them.
Now, you've been speaking to the beef industry today. What has been the response to these tariffs?
Well, they're saying 10% is bad for business, but it could have been worse. And they're saying, you know, it remains to be seen how US consumers react to these high prices, because ultimately they're the ones that are going to have to pay for it. Simon Stahl, who's the Casino Food Cooperative CEO, says he's already looking at other markets in China and elsewhere in Asia. And the tariffs will cause pain for Australian beef farmers. Let's hear a little bit of what he had to say.
Well, it's going to make the product 10% dearer for someone. And from our point of view, it'll be the importer and the American consumer. You know, there's a lot of demand for Aussie beef around the world. I think they're playing with a little bit of fire, especially with the cost of meat in the US being at record prices now. This will only make things worse.
So that's Simon Stahl, who's the Casino Food Cooperative CEO, who's talking to you there, to Kim Honan.
Michael, while these tariffs are not welcome for Australian exporters to the United States, are there greater concerns around the global economy because of the larger tariffs we've also seen for other countries?
Yeah, that's right, because we're seeing a 34% tariff for China, a 20% tariff for the EU, 26% tariff for India. That's what Donald Trump has imposed as of midnight tonight. And we heard from some economists saying, you know, that this is definitely going to be bad for world trade, which is bad for Australia, because if the world trade is reducing, then they're going to buy less. They'll buy less from Australia, you know, simple as that. We spoke to an economist, the UTS's chief economist Tim Harcourt, who was saying that really what we're seeing, which is also troubling, is that it's a trend that Trump is taking a leaf out of China's book and is using tariffs to punish countries that he doesn't like for the sort of geopolitical things that they're doing. And he says that the fear he has that this tariff on beef, which is not too punitive to us, but it's just the beginning of more punitive damages, and you know, that will see a reduction in demand generally, which is that, and that's the overall world trade concern.
Look, Michael, it's a bad day for the American worker. It's a bad day for the American farmer, and ultimately the American consumer. Putting up tariffs is like putting rocks in your own harbour. To some extent, this was a trade war started by China. After Australia called for the COVID-19 inquiry, China imposed those tariffs on us, on many of our farmers. And it's given Donald Trump the idea that you can use geopolitical issues to impose tariffs. And that's ultimately a really bad result for the world. A good thing could be the Europeans now take Australia seriously, and we think about opening up trade with Europe. I was with the Polish delegation on Monday. They're taking Australia very seriously. So perhaps that could spread to the rest of Europe.
So that's UTS Chief Economist Tim Harcourt there.
And finally, you know, at this stage, do we know whether there might be flow-on effects for, you know, Australians at the supermarket purchasing beef?
There's a lot of things that are at play there. Domestically, we've seen the floods in Queensland reducing supply. We've had some dry weather in South Australia and Victoria that's, you know, causing a reduction in the beef and lamb production and things like that. I would say it's more likely that we're going to see a rise in prices for beef and lamb because of domestic seasonal issues than because of trade issues.
Michael, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
No worries, thanks.
Michael Condon there, he's the presenter of the New South Wales Country Hour.
ABC Australia Wide.
We head again to southwest Queensland, where the rain has finally eased and displaced residents anxiously wait to understand the full scale of these devastating floods. This part of Queensland is remote. It's hard to comprehend the scale of just how far and wide the waters have flowed. And it's been helicopter pilots who've played a crucial role in rescues, delivering much-needed supplies, water, food, fuel, and who've captured footage so that the rest of the country knows what's happening in these far-flung communities. Tyler Sklipper is a pilot. He's usually based in Port Douglas, but currently is in Longreach and has been helping as best he can. Tyler, it's really good to talk to you. First up, can you describe what you've seen as you've flown over southwest Queensland?
Yeah, Alex, no worries. It's at the start it was quite confronting. Pretty much as we were flying out there to the southwest, it was kind of like flying over the ocean. That's the way it felt in some parts. Then as we got lower, we started to see all the cattle, sheep, and a lot of the stations. And it wasn't too much left that wasn't in the water. It was quite confronting actually.
Had you seen anything like that before?
No, I've never seen anything quite like that before. It's just, you can't really fathom the amount of water that was coming down there. You do really feel for everyone out there.
Can you tell me a bit about your helicopter and how it's been used through this?
Yeah, so pretty much a helicopter. It's a Bell 205, pretty much a civilian Huey. It's pretty much capable. We can cart up to about 15 people and, lots of gear. So pretty much at the minute, we've been carting swift water rescue crews around. They're like two rescue blow-up boats, with motors, all of their gear bags, rescue equipment, life jackets. And so we've been cutting around four personnel, all that gear, and pretty much dropping them right at the heart of all the action down there just so they can assist with rescuing and getting people out of there.
So tell me a bit about where you've been.
They've based the aircraft out of Longreach, so pretty much we've been heading down towards Stonehenge and Junda and all the way down through to Windora. That's pretty much as far as we've gone at the minute. There's been quite a bit happening down that way. We're moving into the recovery stage at the minute where we're just trying to keep all of the avgas and fuel for all the other station aircraft out there that are doing fodder drops and just trying to assess all of the cattle and sheep.
And in terms of actual people, have you had to drop some of those boats to rescue people?
Yeah, so the first couple of days, once the weather cleared and we could get aircraft in there, we were landing in Junda. There was quite a few people in there they were quite concerned about. There was we did drop a crew of four people in there, a rescue crew. They boated over and there was some elderly there that we had to put on the aircraft and pretty much get them back to Longreach as they might have need some medical attention, and also some kids as well. So we don't really want kids sort of seeing a lot of that stuff up there. The boys doing a great job that one.
I suspect that you have helped people who are experiencing some pretty raw emotions in the midst of all of this.
Yeah, I can't imagine what a lot of them station owners and that are going through, just trying to account for all their livestock. And there's obviously like lots of silt build up, fences that are gone, machinery. You do really feel for them.
How long do you think you'll be doing this for?
Now that the rain sort of is easing off a little bit, I hope it can hold out there for a little bit and we can get a little bit of a head start on it. I'm suspecting we'll be out here for another few weeks yet.
It's a huge effort, Tyler. I'm sure many people appreciate it. And thank you so much for speaking with me.
No dramas. Take care.
Tyler Sklipper there. He's a pilot, usually based with his company in Port Douglas, currently in Longreach though, and they've been employed by Queensland Fire and Emergency Services. We head to regional Victoria now, where the energy transition is something that many communities are dealing with. Some are embracing the change and others are grappling with the challenges. And in some of Australia's renewable energy hotspots, residents say they've been forced to create their own community information groups to address concerns about the nation's rapid energy transition. And those groups are now lobbying for the establishment of local energy hubs in regional areas. Erin Somerville reports.
New South Wales Hunter Region resident Peter Coughlin describes his area as being at the epicentre of the transition to renewable energy, and he worries locals are missing out on vital engagement over the projects.
Certainly we see it being a substantial gap in the Hunter.
He's a part of the Hunter Community Alliance, which began forming in 2018 out of need, after community leaders identified a lack of unity, engagement and understanding over the many flagged renewable projects. But it's a big job, and they now want more help via a federally funded local energy hub, which would assist by fielding locals' questions and concerns.
There is a lot of uncertainty and in some quarters misunderstanding relating to the whole energy space. And a local energy hub would definitely help us address those concerns.
Community support groups like the Hunter Community Alliance are popping up across many of Australia's renewable hotspots, including in Burnie in northwest Tasmania. The future energy hub there is supported by the Cradle Coast Authority and has been working in partnership with local industry since 2019, providing a space where people can access information relevant to local renewable development concerns. Cradle Coast Authority Regional Development Manager Veronica Terry says the job's becoming too big and more help to support locals is needed.
We are trying to play a role in that space, and we can see that we don't have the resources to do the kind of work that we want to do.
She says a long-term approach during the nation's energy transition is vital, especially as some communities remain divided over the future of renewables.
It's not a one and done. It is about developing that trust.
And Geelong Sustainability in Victoria is also keen for a hub. Here's their CEO, Jane Spence.
For us, increasingly there are going to be these projects, there's these larger conversations that are happening around renewable energy zones and identifying opportunities and areas.
The Renewable Energy Alliance wants to see 50 local energy hubs established around Australia. Its National Director, Andrew Bray, says the hub's omission from last month's federal budget could slow down the renewables rollout.
It's critical that communities who are involved in these regions are on board and that they get to see some benefits out of these projects. When communities are against it, it can, you know, create difficulties with the communities themselves, and you see some divisions. The projects themselves stall. That becomes harder to meet the targets.
The Clean Energy Council and Smart Energy Council, which represent major renewable energy companies, told the ABC they would also welcome the hub's establishment. The spokeswoman for the Federal Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Chris Bowen, says the government's acted on its community engagement review findings while a developer rating scheme is underway, but acknowledged there's more ways to ensure communities benefit from the renewables shift. Mr. Bray warns regional communities should not be overlooked in that shift.
That's going to be where you see people sort of become more involved with the projects and see them as something that's good for their region.
Erin Somerville with that report. Staying in Victoria, after another tough fire season, farmers have launched a last-ditch effort to block a fire tax hike that could cost them tens of thousands of dollars. Andrew Kelso has this story.
There was controversy last year when the Victorian government announced it would be replacing the fire services levy, a tax collected from property owners, with a broader emergency services and volunteers fund, demanding a greater contribution from landholders. The ESVF intends to cover the costs of a greater range of emergency services, but several advocacy bodies around Victoria have warned about a potentially unfair burden on rural ratepayers. Ahead of the possibility the legislation could be passed today in Parliament, the Victorian Farmers Federation is calling for the fund to be blocked or referred to a parliamentary inquiry. Their president, Brett Hosking, said some farmers could see an increase of up to $40,000.
Nobody we've met or engaged with has said, oh no, this is a great idea as it is. Not one single member of the upper house has said that. They've also, all of them have said, you know what, we've got some real concerns about it. So what we could end up seeing is less product going into supermarket shelves. What we will definitely end up seeing is increased stress on our farmers. What we could potentially see is more farm accidents with people pushing themselves that bit harder as well. The government needs to really rethink this one. They've made a mistake.
Although the fund is a state government tax, it will, like the fire services levy before it, appear on council rate notices, and councils themselves will be forced to collect it. Something that Rob Amos, Chair of Rural Councils Victoria, who represent 33 smaller municipalities statewide, says needs to be changed.
The state government has an entity called the State Revenue Office, and if they want to collect levies, then we believe it should be done through them and not through councils. But as I said, we don't think it should be done at all. We do a lot of advocacy for our rural councils. That's our role. And I have to say, this is one of the strongest ones that we've received requests to go and talk to the decision makers on this.
RCV say the Emergency Services and Volunteers Fund should be scrapped or changed, and last week released figures which state primary producers, like farmers, could see an increase of more than 150%. Mayor of West Wimmera Shire, Tim Meir, has also been outspoken against
it. Myself personally, what I want to do is put out a pamphlet to all our residents with a photo of the Premier on it, saying this is who's responsible for this tax.
Leader of the Victoria Nationals and Shadow Minister for Emergency Services, Danny O'Brien, described the levy as a great big new tax grab.
This is a big new tax. It's going to have an impact on all Victorians, but particularly our farmers. And indeed, you know, that adds costs and that ultimately can add to the price of food and have an impact at a cost of living crisis time.
Should the levy pass through Parliament, Mr O'Brien said he would not commit to scrapping it if the opposition gained power next year, saying it would be hard to, quote, unscramble the egg. But the Victorian government remains committed to the Emergency Services and Volunteers Fund and does not support a parliamentary inquiry. In a statement, a government spokesperson said delaying this bill will only delay getting the sustainable funding and equipment our emergency services need to keep Victorians safe and to recover from natural disasters. They say every single dollar raised by the Emergency Services and Volunteers Fund will support emergency services, and that from the ESVF, the government has dedicated more than $250 million to support CFA and Vic SES volunteers across the state. Speaking in Parliament this week, Treasurer Jacqueline Symes said the cost increase for farmers would be very, very small and would equate to 0.5 to 0.8% of the value of agricultural production. If it does pass today, the ESVF would come into effect on July 1st.
That report from Andrew Kelso. Let's head to Mackay in Queensland now, where amateur radio operators are playing a small but important part in receiving pictures from the first space flight in polar orbit. The history-making FRAM-2 mission launched this week, and one Mackay man is listening very carefully from his home for when the capsule passes over Australia, as Danielle Jesser reports.
When Shane Lind hears a series of telltale beeps, he'll know that the base station in his central Queensland home has acquired a signal with the SpaceX capsule passing overhead.
Well, it's something quite unique in the sense that once you've got a radio transmitter on board a space vehicle, and that space vehicle is orbiting the Earth, just the thrill or the ability to be able to communicate directly with the crew on board that space vehicle, it's quite exciting.
Zero Tango Uniform, I got you loud and clear. How me?
The FRAM-2 mission is named after the famous polar exploration ship FRAM, which completed voyages to the Arctic and Antarctica between 1893 and 1912. This modern-day venture is funded by cryptocurrency entrepreneur Chung Wang, who is on board and launched on Tuesday from Cape Canaveral, Florida.
Go for launch. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition.
So the FRAM-2 mission is basically a scientific mission of a space launch that involves orbiting both the North and South Pole. So it's something that hasn't been done before. The FRAM-2 crew will be transmitting what we refer to as slow scan television, or SSTV. So basically it's a single frame video picture, and that's transmitted directly from the equipment as the FRAM-2 capsule passes over Australia. And the idea is to try and decode that that slow scan TV image. Basically like photographs, but to listen to the data with the raw ear, it sounds a bit like musical tones. We have some smart software which decodes that software and then transforms it into an image like a photograph.
It will take just 46 minutes to travel between the poles as the crew conduct experiments including growing mushrooms and conducting the first human X-ray in space. It's a significant mission as the North and South Poles aren't visible from the ISS and have only been seen from a distance by the Apollo missions. One room in Shane Lynn's house is filled with antennas, amplifiers, transmitters and radio receivers, As you walk into his garage, there's a wall of screens showing upcoming flight paths for the International Space Station and trajectories for the Fram 2 mission. He's one of around 17,500 licensed amateur radio operators in Australia and one of only three nationally who make it possible for school students to talk to astronauts on the International Space Station.
All of our transmissions that occur from the ISS to date have mostly been on VHF radio, which is line of sight radio. So I've got two VHF transmitters, or they're actually VHF UHF transmitters, antennas which are homemade. There's the switching networks, amplifiers, power supplies, all that sort of thing. Most of that equipment is equipment that I've accumulated over the last probably 30 years, or many pieces of those equipment are homemade as well. And the advantage of that, of course, is if something goes wrong, you know how to fix it.
Shane is also hopeful of making voice contact with the astronauts during their passes over Australia.
I've done this probably, I've had probably more than 80-odd contacts directly with the crew on the space station over the last 20 years. No two contacts are ever the same, and I get an enormous buzz out of each of them. In actual fact, to each of those contacts, I'll often walk around pacing the hallway right up until acquisition of signal. You'll have your 10-minute contact and then just huge relief after it. But yes, all of them, you get quite a buzz out of them.
This is Victor Kilo, 4 Kilo Hotel Zulu, near Mackay in Queensland, Australia. Over.
Hey, good to talk to you there in Queensland.
Shane Lind speaking with astronauts from his home in Mackay. That report from Danielle Jesser.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And finally, to the Sunshine Coast. Quolls are iconic for their spotted fur and pink noses. As well as being adorable, they're also the mainland's largest native carnivores. But even apex predators face their own battles. Nikki Sorbello with this report.
Sure, I work with quite a few threatened species, but quolls are my absolute favourite. Just don't tell the gliders I said that. I'm quoll mad.
Paul Reevey is a man on a mission.
They're very, very highly threatened. And they're one of those species that not a lot of people know about. So they're one of those species that could sort of fade into extinction without too much fanfare or fuss. So, we're here to make sure that doesn't happen.
The project officer for the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland has been studying quolls for many years, but his latest survey, looking for evidence of the spotted tail or northern quoll, has him worried. From April to October last year, researchers conducted camera trapping surveys, motion-triggered cameras set up across more than 100,000 hectares of state forest and national parks west of Gympie and the Sunshine Coast in Queensland's southeast. They didn't see a single quoll.
When they're around in reasonable numbers, you pick them up quite easily with camera traps, but if they're only at really low densities or confined to a fairly narrow geographic range, it can be really difficult. The fact that we didn't find any in this project doesn't necessarily mean they're not there. It just means they're at very, very low densities if they are around, which unfortunately means they're probably functionally extinct and they're no longer performing that key role of an apex predator in the landscape that they used to do.
Mr. Reevey says the endangered marsupial carnivores, often the size of a house cat, are nothing like their cute and cuddly reputation.
They are absolutely ferocious predators despite what their appearance sort of looks like. So a quoll that size has got no problem taking down like a small wallaby, like something three or four times its own size. And if they are hunting things like wallabies, what they'll do is they'll leap onto the back of them and they've got a really, really strong bite force. So they'll just latch onto the back of the neck and snap the spinal cord or break the vertebrae in a single bite, pretty much like a miniature leopard, the miniature leopard of the Australian bush.
There's evidence the apex predators used to roam larger areas of Queensland, but introduced species like foxes, cats and cane toads have seen their numbers decline.
So unfortunately, when we talk about quolls, that role's sort of been usurped now by foxes and cats, our two introduced medium-sized predators that now sort of are really high densities throughout most areas where you would have formerly found quolls. So yeah, it's a real shame that instead of beautiful spotty quolls climbing in trees, we've instead got cats and foxes performing the same tasks.
Ecologist Dr. Scott Burnett wasn't involved in the most recent camera trapping survey, but has been studying quolls for 30 years.
He says he wasn't surprised by the results.
It's certainly indicative of an environmental trajectory that we're on. They're a bit of a canary in the coal mine for us, really, because they are so reliant on healthy mammal populations on which they prey. They really sort of indicate when ecosystems start to decline. Now, I hazard to say it, but I think the spotted-tailed quoll is probably one of those species that really are just a warning sign. There's probably not a lot we can do in day-to-day life to bring them back into areas where they once were. But that said, there's a lot that can be done in areas where they still exist, protect those populations. And that's why it's so important to keep looking and trying to confirm exactly where they do still exist and where they seem to have disappeared.
In Queensland, quoll populations are strongest around Warwick and Stanthorpe and west to Gundawindi.
The key really is to find if there is any remaining populations and then to, you know, spend all your time protecting those populations and ultimately expanding them out into some of their former areas.
Paul Reevey, Project Officer for the Wildlife Preservation Society, ending that story from Nikki Sorbello. And that's Australia Wide for this Thursday. My name's Alex Barwick. Have a lovely evening.
ABC Listen.